for this retreat, like at the beginning when I said everything belongs. So all that's happened and you've experienced, good or bad, what you wanted or haven't wanted, is it all belongs. I find this way of reflecting it gives me a way of being, allowing life to be what it is, rather than this kind of conditioned attitude of there's something wrong in it and I've got to make it right. But I find this, if you really look at this perception of there's something wrong with me, or something wrong with you, or wrong with the world, or the monastery, and I've got to make it right. And then that very perception means that it increases this attitude of I am this body, these conventions are real, and if they aren't perfect, if they aren't just absolutely at their best, then there's something wrong and we've got to spend our life trying to make everything perfect. Or perfect myself, and the logic that comes from that then, of course, is leads to despair, because it's like trying to sweep the streets of London clean with a toothbrush. You know, as soon as you manage to clean up a little bit and go on to the next, then it gets dirty again. So, I mean, it's a hopeless task. So when we recognize what we perfection is all inclusive rather than the best. This is a way of reflecting, like this moment is perfect as it is, no matter how you're experiencing it. Because even if you're absolutely miserable, in pain and suicidal, then that's perfect for this moment. The moment you reflect on it in that way, but then you've got a perspective on it. You're no longer just kind of absorbed into your misery or the pain or the chaos of the world around you. And so this ability to reflect gives us a way of letting go, of kind of freeing ourselves from the apparent reality that we tend to regard as the real world, or the real self, real what I really am. Then taking the Buddhist teachings, like just this recognition of consciousness, that this is a conscious realm we're experiencing. Right now, we're all conscious. Vijnana, so that this consciousness is like this, and you're not trying you can acknowledge or recognize consciousness. It's quite empty, you know, it's not like it, but the consciousness includes everything. So you're within your field of consciousness at this moment, everything that is present belongs. And then with identifying with Rupa, Vedana, Sanya, Sankara, then we divide it up. It becomes my body and my feelings, my memories, my thoughts, my emotions, my opinions, my views, and then that arises in consciousness, but we're not aware of the difference, where it's just pure awareness and consciousness. And where there's consciousness, that is filled with ignorance, avijja. So this is what you can explore, you know, to recognize, to realize this yourself. Well, consciousness has no you know, quality to it other than a kind of than being conscious. And it's this. It's like this. But then, just by reflecting this way, it's like this. What happens to me? And then I kind of open to that. I kind of start kind of in this intuitive sense. I'm not trying to figure it out anymore or find it, but just recognize it. You know, like the fish in the water. It's just, if you're the fish who says, "What's water like?" And yet it's surrounding, going through the fish's body, but it's so imminent that we can, you know, we can be aware of that, of each other, more than of what is really a very strong reality of this present moment is consciousness. Also, to try to define everything, to feel you have to sum it up with words and Pali terms and definitions in order to feel secure about consciousness. Trust yourself in that consciousness is like this. And it's a sense of just presence. It's an intelligent presence. It's not a kind of trance or stupid state, vacuous state. And then the sense of a self. Put yourself into the consciousness. Now it's not really, I am this body. I'm 60. I'll be 68 this year. I'm a man. I'm a Buddhist monk. I'm Ajahn Sumedho, and really, you know, bring yourself, you know, your self views, your identities with your body, your feelings, emotions. Make them conscious, but in a way that you're observing them. Right? So it's with consciousness, with awareness. You're not just operating from ignorance and getting caught in the trap of just going around and around with this in the cycles of your habits. But then you reflect these things, this sense of I'm Ajahn Sumedho, I'm a Buddhist monk and all that, these things, these are, you know, conventionally, what they call conventional reality, but they don't hold, there's nothing that sustains itself in any of this. But when they drop, those perceptions drop, this sense of being conscious is still present. There's still awareness, conscious awareness. And so this is what we call intuitive awareness, or satipanya, satisampajanya. So this, if you cultivate this way, then you can get behind all the conditioning of your mind. You know, you're not just starting from ignorance or subtle forms of ignorance or assumptions, cultural attitudes or things that, you know, you've never questioned and never seen through it. Like assumptions, like there's something wrong with me. Or we pick up when you're a child, you know, the first few years of your life from parents, from peers and so forth, from ethnic attitudes, assumptions of your class or race and that. It's consciousness, awareness, consciousness. If you trust it, then you can get beyond, you can transcend the limitations of any kind of conditioning that you have acquired, whether, you know, through infancy or through education or whatever. When putting this in the context of the three fetters, first three fetters, and stream entry, sotapanna, you know, like the sotapanna or the stream entra, is a has seen through these three fetters, no longer taken over, deluded, limited, distorting reality through these three fetters. The sakkaya ditti, which the personality view, I am my body, I am this person, my feelings, my thoughts, my likes, my needs, my dislikes, my faults, and so forth. The whole sense of me and mine can be, that's a created condition. You weren't born with that. That you acquired after you were born and already conscious. But that's very conditioned. That's not, let's say, natural. It's artificial kind of conditioning. So, and it can be any which way. That's why, you know, the sense of yourself and your self-worth is so valuable from one person to another. And people got really distorted, you know, really mad perceptions that they believe in and operate from. You see, with people that go crazy and fully committed to madness, to perceptions that they're so bound to, they distort every possible moment through these perceptions of themselves and the world around them that they're committed to, believe in, but that's not really the way it is. Then Sila Patta Paramartha, in that category, put every convention, cultural perception, religious tradition, everything that is social attitudes, all your kind of heroes and ideals and things that we really bind ourselves to on the conditioned realm, like our cultural background, our ethnic identity, our religious tradition, our view of Dhamma Vinaya. That can be Sila Patta Paramartha also, holding to a view about Dhamma and Vinaya, or Theravada, Mahayana, or Thai forest tradition, or any of these things. These views aren't wrong. I mean, they're not to judge them, but to recognize a view is a view. In a way, we interpret these through our the conditioning of our mind, rather than through reflecting, through awakening and reflecting on the reality, the real Dhamma. We tend to think we understand Dhamma through having acquired knowledge about it, through reading scriptures. Now this is like empowering you to trust in this intuitive sense, rather than in what a book says, or what a teacher says, or where we give our power away to others all the time. Ajahn Sumedho, you're wise, you know what I need. And that way, you're kind of giving me your burden. You say, tell me what to do. Then, because you project onto me a sense that I'm wise and you're not. And yet, in that very assumption, in that if you trust in your awareness of that, of how we tend to see ourselves in these very limited ways. I'm a mess. I'm not very wise. I'm on a conventional level. This is how it seems to us and how we interpret our experience. So this is, we're trusting this innate awakened state, which you can always, if you're willing to accept the reality of it, you think, I'm not very wise. Ajahn Sumedho is very wise. He knows what's good for me. When you really see that as an assumption you're making or an attitude you have, then you're creating that. That's your own creation, isn't it? That's not the way it is. That's not the reality of this moment, that I'm wise and you're not. That's just what you're creating into this present moment, the assumption you're making. So what is it that's aware of that? what is aware of that tendency to assume I'm not wise, you are. You know, as you explore that, you begin to see how much of your life you have done that, just operating through distortions of yourself. And that's why we suffer so much, because we're always intimidated by others, or, you know, we don't feel, you know, we always look at others and say, compare them with ourselves, compare ourselves with others. And we're actually creating these perceptions, aren't we? I think that monk is really much better monk than I. I'm creating that view out of ignorance, out of avicca, bhajya sankhara, sankhara bhajya vinyanang, in the paticca samuppada. So if ignorance is the basis, then it affects our conscious reality, how we see, how we experience, what we experience through consciousness is distorted by that avicca. And then it ends up always as sukha pariteva tukato manasu payasa, grief, sorrow, despair, and anguish. So as long as this avicca is your base for operation, your modus operandi, the place you've never gone beyond, you start from ignorance, you meditate, you're starting from avicca, you know, trying as hard as dedicated and as determined as you are, if you never get beyond that basic ignorance, you know, then you'll be disappointed. You'll have sukha pariteva, you'll have grief and despair as a result. This is a reflection just to see how the self-view in any way always, you know, it's just so unreal and so ephemeral, and yet we assume the reality of it. We're committed to such a delusion, but until we start questioning, like reflecting, is this, what am I doing? What is this all about? And the conventions we use, I like say, I'm from a very idealistic background, where you think in terms of how things should be, the ideals of how there should be justice and freedom and love in the world, and evil shouldn't exist, people shouldn't hate each other, and there shouldn't be war and violence, and I shouldn't be selfish. I should always, you know, I should be a man who's fair and just, unselfish, compassionate, impeccable in conduct and understanding. I should be like that. So taken, you know, on that level, these are quite beautiful ideals. You know, so, but then if that's the basic, that's the kind of program that I start from, then there's always this sense of not being good enough. You know, that's why we so many of us Western people have so much guilt, and we're so complicated, emotionally complicated and convoluted, because it's just a struggle all the time with these ideals we have and the way we interpret the reality of this moment. So I shouldn't be selfish. I should be totally unselfish. And then suddenly I have very selfish feelings. So I get confused because, you know, emotionally I'm feeling very selfish. And ideally I think I shouldn't be selfish. And so it's just, you feel this, I was judging, I shouldn't be thinking like this, I shouldn't feel like this. I've got to get rid of these thoughts. I'm really a mess, you know. I've really got to do something about myself. Get rid of this selfishness. I found, you know, just in my own life, it was very idealistic about non-violence. So I was attracted to the Gandhian movement and this attitude of non-violence as an ideal. And so that's such a kind of beautiful ideal. Then I was very much, you know, that would inspire me. You can get really inspired by it. And then I'd feel, you know, myself sometimes feeling violent. And then just not being able to admit it, you know, just suppressing those feelings. And just trying to pretend, you know, I wasn't feeling them. There's a kind of defense mechanism, these kind of words where you just don't admit it. There's a part of you that cuts off from it because it's unacceptable. So then, as I became a Buddhist monk, and this a way of mindfulness, then I started acknowledging, you know, these violent feelings. And not putting them in a context of judgment, of, you know, I shouldn't have these, or these are bad and I shouldn't have these feelings, but admitting them, allowing them to be conscious in this reflective way. Well, not act on it, but, or speak on it, but just recognize it's like this. And not shame myself for having emotions that intellectually I despise. Ideally, my idealistic mind looks down on and despises. So, and this is, then the confusion, the complexity falls away, doesn't it? You're not complicating the moment. No, that's why we get so confused between the emotional program we're stuck with and the maybe the very high-minded, idealistic view of life that we subscribe to. Like in a monastery, isn't it? This ideal of, I want this monastery to be, you know, perfect harmonious sangha. Peaceful, and I can idealize, you know, a perfect Buddhist monastery where we're all dedicated to the realization of nirvana and all, you know, practicing according to Dhamma Vinaya, and we're all, you know, reaching these stages and purifying the mind, and there's harmony and wisdom operating. That's an ideal. But then the reality, that's you know, the ideal's fine. That's the guiding star. That's high up. But the reality of here and now is like this. So then, the more we can embrace that reality, allowing it to be what it is, the conditions as they arise in the present, then more and more we actually are moving toward the ideal. But as we look up at the ideal and compare the present with the way it is with an ideal of how it should be, then we only get confused. We lose our way and we get stuck. So then Sila Patibhamasa is just take this term, Pali term, and, you know, use that for containing all the conventional the assumptions that you have and that you're using, you know, the Dhamma Vinaya, the conventional Dhamma Vinaya, the Buddhism, cultural conditioning, the kind of superstitions or cultural biases you have, you know, just see these in terms of Sakya Ditti Sila Patta Paramasa. So this covers all the conditioned realm, really, in terms of your own experience of it. You know, your own individual experience of life, in terms of the way you are, the program that you have. Then the third fetter is the vichikicca, doubt. Not knowing, uncertainty. And so when you give up your sense of being a person and being, you know, the kind of stability of knowing I am this person and I am these conventions, you know, the things that we feel that give us some kind of importance and some stability in this confusing realm, you know, then we get very confused, uncertain, being frightened, terrified, because like the world that seems so stable and certain and real for us suddenly is cracked, it's shattered. And some people get very terrified, you know, they're really frightening at first. I remember when the security of my world as a youth started shattering, I became very frightened. Then my first reaction was to want to hold on, you know, put it all back together like Humpty Dumpty, you know, try to fit it all the pieces together again. But all the king's horses and all the king's men couldn't put Humpty Dumpty together again. So the shattered world is got a, that's, you know, that's a sign, a good sign. But fear and terror, isn't it? That all comes into this not knowing. I don't know who I am anymore. I don't know where I'm at. I don't have any, you know, I'm just totally confused. I don't know what to do next. It's very frightening, and I'm like in the dark, I'm stumbling, and all this not knowing, uncertain, darkness. These are terrifying. We want the light on, we want to have clear directions, guidelines, principles. So many people, you know, find somebody very strong leader or a strong partner or, dedicate themselves to something, you know, because it's too frightening to face the unknown, the uncertain, the mystery, and it's too, for most of us, it's so overwhelming that to give ourselves to something certain, find a strong, you know, somebody tell me what to do, it can make me feel all right. So in this way, in terms of being a samana, there is the community holds together, doesn't it? We've got the vinaya as an agreement on how we're going to live together and relate to the world around us. And so that is, that's something that gives us boundary in terms of action and speech. We need that. And if we don't have any boundary on behavior, you know, it's just anything goes. You just like a leaf in a storm. Nothing holds you down. So in say, making a commitment in a monastic form is like you're kind of holding yourself down. You're putting yourself in a cage, tying yourself to the stake. It's like breaking a wild horse, isn't it? To break a wild horse, you have to tie it up first till it calms down. But then, if we don't awaken, then we identify the cage, with the cage we're in. You know, we're afraid of it. We're afraid to go outside it. We become institutionalized. We become, bound and limited by the convention because we're not reflecting from it. We're merely holding to it. And we remember, we might have memories of how frightened we were before we got into the cage, where we're tied to the stake. But then the point of boundary and limitation is simplification. You know, so you're not, you know, you have a kind of physical stability, you know, where you're actually committed to something. That is, say, in a tradition like this, it's not somebody's new idea. It's not a new age kind of fashion. It's not, you know, so we're not here to try to make it into what we like, you know, trying to, I'll become a Theravada and Buddhist monk or nun, but I want to change this, and I don't like that, and I want to make like this, and I don't, and modify it like that, and we end up, you know, bending it always to fit what we think we need and want, rather than reflecting on that, using the very frustrations and inadequacies of the convention we're in for awareness, for awakenness. But then to identify with the convention is still avicca bhajya sankhara. So you become strongly identified with Theravada, Thai forest tradition, strict Vinaya, and all the rest. Still, you're still stuck with the same, you know, you've maybe improved a bit in terms of the perceptions you're using, and you've kind of raised the quality of the condition realm up a little bit, but the result's still dukkha, because you haven't cracked through the avicca. Now recognize you can hold Dhamma Vinaya with avicca. And you see this a lot, just strong views about things, about the, you know, what the Buddha taught and so on. And the way that academics or that can endlessly quibble over things, you know, that positions, take positions, form opinions. So the point of the samadhi life then is to, you know, it's an aid, it's a skillful means to see through avicca. And that very act of seeing is avicca, you know, so it's immediate. It's not like you have to take a course in avicca studies. Or I can tell you what it is, and you just, Ajahn Sumedho defines avicca as this, and then you've got it, you know. Now this is where this is an imminent act of trust. You start from awareness, from the empty, still point, which is uncertain and unknowing, isn't it? It's not, you can't, when your desire mind, you know, it's like, what is it? You know, I can't find it. What's he talking about? If you trust in the awareness of just your own not knowing, confusion, or whatever you're feeling at this moment, it's like this. Whatever I'm feeling at this moment is like this. That awareness is embracing, isn't it? But it's not criticizing. criticize, you say, I shouldn't feel. If you're feeling something you don't like, then you add something more to it. I shouldn't feel like this. I don't want to feel like this. But if you begin to trust in the allowing whatever feeling, physical, emotional, whatever, to be the way it is, how do you do that? So then this unknowing, vicikicca, doubt, these three fetters are, you know, they kind of connect with each other very well. It's all about conditions that we're attached to. Thought itself, when you think a lot, you're going to doubt a lot. And so when you try to figure it all out, and you'll end up, maybe I've got it wrong. So doubting, vicikicca, is like this, not knowing, feeling confused, uncertain, like this. And so then the embracing that feeling of not knowing, when many of us have been highly programmed to resist that, you know, if I don't know something, I've got to find the answer right now. So not knowing also is a way of recognizing the world is uncertain. This conditioned realm that we, you know, like this earth, the ground beneath us, and the planet, and the dwellings that we live in. We like to feel their solidity, like this temple, you know. We built it the last 1,000 years. The foundations under it, there's tons of cement that this temple sits on. Big oak posts and beams and thick walls, and fortress-like. And it gives a sense of, you know, strength and stability. But actually this realm is very uncertain, and, you know, you can see just how nature always has its way of letting us know, you know, that all our investments in security can easily be just taken away overnight. So your strength comes in awareness and wisdom rather than in, say, bricks and mortar. Or having everything neatly packaged and spelled out and, in, you know, nicely presented and affirmed by the authorities and approved of by all the important people and so forth. You know, that sense of yourself as being a worthy person and being capable and lovable and all that is, you know, that always trying to find that from outside or have certainty, certitude and guarantees. You see, when you get behind that desire and need for that, that very awareness of it, trust in that. So uncertainty then, doubt, anicca, dukkha, anatta. So we're relating to these now through intuitive awareness rather than through definition, through trying to conceive it and define and create a false certainty through having a nice neat package that we kind of cling to desperately. So it is scary in this way, you know, emotionally not knowing, uncertainty, taking risks, going into the unknown, the dark, the abyss, the black hole. These are frightening images. And yet these are the more you open to that, to the unknown, the dark, the uncertain, the mystery, then you realize nothing to fear. Because the fear comes out of thinking about all that. Well, I'm afraid of the dark. I just feel so utterly confused and so frightened by not knowing things. I mean, I want to have clarity. I want to have guidelines. I want to have certainty. I want to feel safe. I want to feel, you know, that everything's all right. And I can't do it myself. I mean, you know, I need this from somebody else. I need affirmations. I need physical situations. I need material objects to make me feel safe and secure. As these kind of fears and doubts arise, you know, the listener, the one who knows this, is not the same as the fear or the anxiety, is it? You begin to separate the two, discern the difference between that sense of I need certainty, I need affirmation, I need to know who I am, I need approval, I need safety, to that which is aware of that, which has no name. You can only be that, rest in it, relax into awareness, into the pure presence. So like in Christianity, people that have this strong sense of the presence of God, that's what they're doing, I assume. Isn't it? They have a strong sense or faith in the pure presence of God. That's one way of putting it, isn't it, in Christian terms. In our tradition, we get confused because this word self gets in the way all the time. Because we're, like in Theravada, there's no self. And we tend to cling to that view of no self, no God, and that kind of, those assumptions we make. Well, these are only words, you know, these are created perceptions. But in the reality of this moment, you know, you're trusting in the pure presence. You needn't call it anything, it doesn't belong, you know, it doesn't need a name. If you just trust it, and to trust it, you need to open and feel it, know it, be with it, and be patient because you're not conditioned for that. You're conditioned to become a person, to become your personality. So you get very confused and restless, and it seems impossible on a personal level. And this is where I keep encouraging this trust that you in this sati sampatthanya. Well, in Christianity, what gets confusing is that God becomes, the perception of God gets in the way also. Because they define it endlessly. They anthropomorphize. They make it, you know, God into Trinity, and it becomes so complicated. You get this patriarchal God, and you know, the kind of that you can't help but rebel against when you're a teenager. No, I mean, don't let the words become the, you know, they're just expedient means. They're not ends in themselves. They're not, do you believe, you know, Christians like to ask, do you believe in God? And they, you know, as if, what do you mean by that? You know, they assume that what their belief is, we all either believe or disbelieve. There's an assumption about God, and that assumption hasn't been questioned, hasn't been you know, seen. They merely operate from I believe in God, and then the assumptions you make are from that position. And then if you don't believe in it anymore, then I don't believe in God. It's a bunch of rubbish. Opiate of the people. So, they're just reflecting from how every convention, you know, in itself is, has its limitations. If we don't use it for awakening and awareness, then we get bound into it, limited and restricted into being, becoming a, some kind of idea, what we think a good Buddhist should be or a good Christian should be. So in this awakening, and this pure presence is reality to me. It's real. A knowing. It's powerful. It sustains itself. It's not created by my desires, by my ideas. So what is it? What do you want to call it? Are the unconditioned good enough? Or deathless? Or I can even call it God now. I mean, you know, brought up as a Christian, but that's not a convention that I teach through. But I have no problems with the words anymore, because it's, you know, the words aren't really, you know, where we bind ourselves to the words, believe in the words themselves, and we're bound endlessly having to defend our position or reject it. When the advisor system, I am that, or the, you know, they use this sense of I am as a kind of focus to get beyond it. I mean, these are using conventions of the various systems have developed, but the point really is in the awakened reality. So during this retreat so far, you know, personally I didn't want to get sick, and I don't like this flu or whatever it is most unpleasant physically, and I was hoping this would never happen. And but that's the way it is, isn't it? It's perfect. Everything belongs. So, you know, this is how we really begin to flow in our practice, where the practice has a continuity. Where if you see practice in limited terms of sitting on yuzafu and doing very formal techniques, then it's very fragmented. You know, practices in the temple, but not in the vihara or in the kitchen or whatever it is. So then you see, you get this idea that the real ones, the real practice is when you're sitting in the temple. And, but when you're in the kitchen, that's not real practice. You just kind of put up with that and do it kind of as an offering and duty and so forth. So then the idea of practice is so fragmented, you know, that this is what we do with our lives, that everything becomes compartmentalized, and life always has this kind of sense of being disrupted, no flow to it. So, in terms of, and that's because we bind ourselves to, we've got these views that hold to a certain thing, and that which doesn't fit into that is somehow, you know, we feel threatened or antagonistic, or, you know, we don't respect that either. where an attitude then of awareness allows the flow, you know, the sickness, the snotty nose, the hoarse voice, the disruption, the disappointment of not getting what I want, and all this, it belongs, rather than thinking of it in terms of, oh, it's disrupted the retreat, and on, like, well, one way I could, you know, see it as some kind of, see it in very negative terms. Now this takes the kind of continuous willingness to investigate, you know, so you really, you're not, I don't mean this to make you compulsive about it, but this is a sense of trusting. Sometimes we need to just let go and hang loose, because we grasp these ideals too much, and then we get too intensely trying to, you know, where even doing the dishes becomes an intense practice of mindfulness. That we've got a fixed view about how we should do it, and then we can make that into another kind of obsessive driven activity, rather than a sense of relax, of joyousness, of presence, of being at ease with life, allowing the monastic life to be a life that gives us pleasure, that delights us, that we love, rather than as an intense experience of denial and restriction and limitation and hard work and striving and on and on like that. And so if you're determined to live the monastic life, then how can we live this life so we really enjoy being monks and nuns? And so then our practice is coming out of the joy of being, rather than out of this compulsive need to try to set everything in order, get everything right. And then the devotional side, the bhakti side, becomes more evident in how we relate to each other, the monastery, or the world we live in. Like religious communities can be very joyful, or they can be just intensely kind of dedicated towards misery, and to make everything as miserable as possible. Then any time you feel happy, it's because you feel guilty about it. And if you enjoy your food, you're not a good nun. You should always see your food as vomit. Make it as horrible as possible. That's a good nun, isn't it? A good monk, nun, they do that. These are ideals, but from the life is, it's not a denial of beauty or pleasure, but of getting perspective on it. And so, like, monastic life is a lot of joy in it. Because it's coming from emptiness. That's its point, is to not to create an institution, kind of morbid institution of miserable looking monks and nuns who constantly kind of trying to purify themselves and get rid of their desires, but of sangha, of people living in a way that's beautiful and worthy of respect. It's a joyful life and has great benefits for both the individual and the society. Because whether you realize or not, this monastery, Amaravati, is like a gift to this society. And then it's a to Britain. You know, we're living in this country, the gift. And I told the Thais, it's like foreign aid. But of the highest quality. So, Americans were giving cruise missiles to Britain a few years ago. quite impressive weapons, but it's not really of the highest quality, is it, of foreign aid, where this is. So then recognize that it does operate on, it has so much goodness to it, that it is I see we're helping, our presence in this country is one of bringing something beautiful, something lovely into this society, rather than some religious cult that's going to try to convert the society and kind of make more divisions and more problems for Britain. I was just reflecting on these three fetters, and then this path, this awareness, is not anything remote. You know, it's not like stream entry or something is such a high attainment that it, and so kind of such hard work. And when you start thinking about it, then it becomes complicated. But it's learning to trust in something very simple, in that which is here and now, in awareness, and breaking down these distortions that we're very attached to. Not rejecting them, not trying to annihilate them, but just see through it, see the way we grasp and hold to conditioned phenomena, to Sakyaditti, to Silabhata Paramartha, to Vichikicca, in which we confuse ourselves endlessly on the conditioned realm. It just overwhelms us all the time, till we can get this perspective on it.